Welcome to Mysterious Goings On, the podcast about creativity, writing, and mystery. Every week, we talk about all kinds of great fiction and meet the people who write it. We also feature explorations about creativity in all walks of life. Your host, Alex Greenwood, will join you right after this.
Hey there, listeners. Alex Greenwood here. You know, one thing I love about hosting Mysterious Goings On is I get to ask the questions I'd want answered if I wasn't the host. That's the questions I ask. But also, I don't just ask questions. I have a give and take. I have a conversation. And I have it on a pretty good authority that the guests really like that style. Don't believe me? Listen to John Gilstrap, New York Times bestselling author of Blue Fire, Crimson Phoenix, and lots more.
You know, I would tell you that I've been doing this for 26 years, so I don't know how many interviews I've done over time, but this is my favorite kind. I like having a discussion. Less experienced interviewers have their list of questions, and you answer their question. And if during the course of answering their question, you confess to the Kennedy assassination, they won't pursue that because they've got to get on to the next question. You know?
Question seven. Thank you, Mr. Oswald. Yes. Where do you get your ideas? That's your favorite question, isn't it?
That is.
There, what can I tell you? Right from the horse's mouth. We have a good time on Mysterious Goings On, and I hope you'll subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, if you want to learn more, go to mgopod.com. Thanks so much for listening, and of course, keep reading. Today, we're diving into the mind behind a captivating murder mystery that weaves together the threads of human psychology, religious insight, and the intricate dance of love and rivalry. Dennis A. Feese, a man whose life reads like an adventure novel, brings us his book, Love, Pride, and Murder. Dennis's journey from the thrill of motorcycle riding and sports car driving to the reflective halls of religious and psychological studies has culminated in a narrative that explores the darkest and most profound corners of the human heart. His novel, inspired by biblical stories, personal explorations, and a passion for mysteries, invites you, the reader, to ponder the complexities of love, pride, and the extremes they can lead to. I think we're in for a really good chat today, so how about I stop talking and start introducing you to Dennis Feese. Welcome to Mysterious Goings On.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've had quite a life's journey, and that was no hyperbole in the intro, but I mean adrenaline pumping adventures on motorcycles and sports cars. I mean, is that for real? Tell us about that. I got to hear this.
It's expanded in the telling, I think. Yeah, I rode bikes, motorcycles, and drove sports cars. I did all of that, but not competitively. I did it dangerously, but then I was young and I did a lot of stupid things, so so it's probably more, it sounds better on paper than it was actually. There were a lot of accidents and broken bones and that kind of stuff.
Ooh, yeah. But, you know, it is, I think, a product of being a young man in America that if you have the horsepower, you are determined to find out just how far you can go with it. I had a 1974 Chevy Impala, the 400 engine that my father foolishly let me have. And yeah, I pushed it a few times. And I got to be honest, Dennis, I think my evolutionary or whatever biological self-protective mode kicked in because it terrified me the couple of times I went over 100. I was just like, what am I doing? Yeah. anyway. But have those types of experiences shaped your approach to your storytelling in any way?
Not consciously. I'm sure that subconsciously there was influence there somewhere, but more, I think more has to do with the kinds of books that I read and the sorts of studies that I've been involved in. And some of the people that I've known, you know, have influenced me over the years. As far as my own experiences are concerned, that's all kind of subliminal. I don't really, you know, tap into that when I'm writing. I do tap into some of the stories that I've heard and some of the books that I've read for style kinds of things. But in terms of reaching out into my past and saying, oh, gee, I'm going to have to chronicle that somehow, that really isn't it.
It's just part of the you're the sum of your experiences. And I have the same way. I mean, certain buttons get pushed while I'm in the writing process, but I don't set out to say, oh, well, I was terrified of driving that car. I mean, it just doesn't enter the way. But I'm just always curious about that. Because also in your makeup, you study theology and you are obviously of a spiritual nature.
Aren't we all?
I think we all are, but we are not all aware that we are. How's that?
Distinction.
Yeah.
No, that's a distinction that's worth exploring, I think. Maybe not in this setting, but because people have a spiritual nature, but it's usually, well, not usually, it is often lost somewhere along the way, I think. I think we're all born with it, and it develops over time if allowed to. But sometimes our society, just the way the world is, it's difficult to explore it and then expand upon it. You know, does that make sense?
It does. And if you'll allow me one quick question about that, then
sure.
You're like, oh, here we go. So do you think, is it a symptom of modern or contemporary society that a lot of humans tend to sublimate their spirituality, or has that always been the case?
Well, it's tempting to blame everything on the current world, but I don't think that's fair, and I don't think it's accurate. I think it's something that's in human nature. I mean, you know, it probably was worse in other societies. We're spoiled in this country. We have a lot of leisure time, and we have a lot of times to dig into ourselves if we're of that nature, or, you know, drive sports cars if that's in your nature, whatever. But roll back 100 years and people were more concerned about taking care of their families or taking care of themselves. And it was a full-time kind of proposition. We didn't have 8-hour days or 10-hour days, and then we had leisure time. It just wasn't there. So looking into the spiritual side of things was either something that was built into the society itself, and it isn't now, at least not here, or it was something that rarely happened unless it was by vocation, maybe. But you know, I'm not referring necessarily to Christianity or Judaism or anything that we're familiar with or more familiar with, but just spirituality in general, just a sense that there's something beyond what is obvious. You know?
Right. Well, it's an endlessly fascinating question, and I've had a previous guest who has similar religious experience and training as you had. And I started asking these questions. She's like, you know, Alex, you're asking the question that man has asked for centuries, and I don't have those answers for you. And I'm like, damn it. Why do I do this show then? All right. Let's get back to the book though. Love, Pride, and Murder. I mean, this work, I think, intricately weaves together the elements of philosophy, theology, and the classic mystery. So share a little bit about how you arrived at this book. It's a plotter pantser question in a way, but did you have this whole thing ready to go, or were you just moved to just start writing something and you saw where it went?
As with the answers to most questions, there's more to it than a yes or a no, or a this is how it happened, this is how it didn't happen. It was a combination of everything you said and some things that you didn't intimate in what you said. I've always written. I've always written in various ways for different reasons, academically, of course, but just for pleasure, just for, you know, my own amusement, or to have something published that wasn't as maybe grand as a novel. I've had one novel published a few years ago, and that was, I don't know about you, but your background in writing, but for me, writing that first novel was more about telling a story that maybe shouldn't have been told or didn't need to be told, but it had to do with this idea that there was something that I had to say that was important, and I wanted to put it down right at that point in time. So I did that.
Yeah.
And this particular book is a mystery, and it's a genre, and it's my personal favorite genre for entertainment.
Yeah.
And there are all sorts of ways that you can write a mystery, and most of them have already been done. You know, it's hard to find a place to squeeze in. But one of the challenges was figuring out a way to write a mystery that wasn't like every other one, but yet had enough of the other sorts of approaches that made it palatable and made it really a mystery. So, and I think if you read the novel, then you know that there are passages or points during the novel where it sounds very much like something that might have come out of a previous era, like the 30s in this country, and maybe something that is a little more current, almost like a cozy type of mystery.
Yeah.
But I tried to kind of navigate between those two poles and come up with something that was a little more unique. I don't know. I hope I achieved that. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's your T.B. Stone. Okay. Right. Yep. This is our hero here, our protag. And he's, you said the 30s, but I was going to leap in and say, yeah, but he's not like your hard boiled Raymond Chandler type by any means. Right. No, but you do have that, the language there. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the I love Raymond Chandler. I think Raymond Chandler was a genius. I really do. I don't think there's any other writer of that era, and I don't care what the kind of novel might be, at least in the States. I think he was as good as anybody out there. And you know, he also got involved in film work, and he got involved in all kinds of things just to make a living.
Right.
But I think that his writing, the Philip Marlowe mysteries, was as good as any writing that was done during that period of time. Now, you know, who am I? But I really appreciated what he did with words and paper and you know, that whole thing. From that point forward, to some extent, I tried to at least give I call it a nod and a bow to that era of writing. Mm-hmm. And I think I did that with the introduction, you know, the way he meets, you know, the first few pages, it's sort of him in his cabin and he's, you know, dealing with the world around him inside his head. But then when he gets to the office and he meets his secretary, who's kind of combative, and she introduces or brings in the person who becomes the second person in the novel, Lucia Nardoni, who is of Italian descent, and that thread runs all the way through the novel. I've had a lot of Italian friends, and that's why I said that that was a compliment, is to think that my name came from some Italian extract, but unfortunately that wasn't the case. Anyway, so I tried to do that. I tried to sort of frame something that sounded, and I was hoping that people would read it and not take it as something that was a requirement in the novel. It was more exactly what it was. It was a good way to introduce it, I thought. And it looked sort of over my shoulder at what a Raymond Chandler might have written, you know, had he been inept. but that's the reason for that. But then as the novel unfolds, all of that kind of goes away, and it leans more towards the cozy type of novel.
Yeah.
But it does have its intense moments, and it doesn't, it strays from that as well. And I didn't intend for it to be a cozy novel either.
Yeah. And I was kind of relieved, because I have nothing against cozy fiction. We've interviewed a lot of cozy authors here, but I just personally, I like a little harder edge with my mystery. I want some stuff to go down, you know? And that's what's lovely about this. And, so he starts out in his cabin. Do you live kind of out in the sticks of ways? You're in Pennsylvania, right? Are you in the city area? Forgive me if I don't remember your bio exactly, but
yeah, I'm halfway between the Scranton area, Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area,
okay,
and the Binghamton Triple Cities in New York State.
Okay,
so the New York State border is about, by driving, about half an hour from where I live. So I live in a town. It's the county seat, if that means anything, for this county. So I live in a neighborhood, and I live in a house that, you know, I look to my right and I see neighbors, and I look to my left and I see neighbors. And so I'm not out in the sticks. That doesn't mean that I haven't lived in the sticks. I have. So I've lived in cities. I've lived out in the country. I've lived in small towns.
Same here. Yeah. And it's interesting. I almost invariably set my stuff in smallish towns, or even small islands or things like that. I find there's something manageable about a cast of characters that can't get, you know, can't be ultimately that huge, right?
Yeah.
So in a way, I kind of pull that drawing room sensibility to the mystery because it's a finite cast. It just shows you that I know my limitations as a writer, and like keeping track of dozens of characters potentially, or plot holes that can be fed by, he lives in New York City, how come he couldn't find a deli, you know, come on, you know, that kind of thing. So I find that interesting. Let's talk about the elephant in the room here, though. It's evident by the title. There's an inspiration from the Book of Genesis here. Can you feed us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the novel was written during the pandemic, the one that you're reviewing. And the nice thing about that, if there was a nice thing about the pandemic, was plenty of time, and I had no excuse for not writing it. I mean, it's easy to, if you're a writer, then you understand. A lot of it is in your head, and you bring it to the when you actually sit down and start trying to mold it, you take a lot of those ideas that have been circulating in your head, and a lot of them just go away as you're writing it. But some say, and that sort of propels what you're writing to some extent. But the hardest part when you're starting something new is to actually sit down and start it. At least for me, and I really didn't have an excuse. There was nothing I could do. I was stuck. You know, you can only eat so many potato chips and drink so much wine, and not necessarily together, but you can't do that forever, you know? And eventually you end up saying, well, I guess it's about time. And then I sat down and started writing it. And then once it started, then it just took off. And that was that's how I filled my time during the pandemic. The whole writing of it, not the editing or the rest of it, took maybe between 6 months and 8 months, I would guess, with revisions and whatnot. So it wasn't, I didn't, you know, crank it out overnight. It was something that I took my time with. I would sit down and I'd start at the same, I'm German, so everything has to be about a clock. And so I would begin at the same time every day, and I'd write typically for the same amount of time. Occasionally some inspiration would strike and I'd sit down and I'd, you know, write a sentence or two, but usually it was just grinding it out on a schedule. And and as you know, no doubt, it's what you bring to it from your thoughts and what the story, there's a certain point where the story starts telling itself. You begin with a very, very wide vista, and then as it progresses, that vista reduces into a path. And with a mystery, the end point of the path is the solution to the mystery. And so as you get towards the end, it becomes more and more difficult to make sure that you have everything in place so it doesn't look like it's out of place or read like it's out of place. And when you get to that final point, then everything seems like it couldn't have been anything else than what it was, if you do it right, I think. And that's not based upon my own experience of writing mysteries, because the one that we're reviewing is the first mystery I ever wrote. It has more to do with what I've read and the way it's just sort of cumulatively been part of the process in my head.
Are you finding now that you've got it under your belt that you want to continue this genre?
Yeah, actually, I've got one that's at the publisher now.
Hey.
And I just found out yesterday that the editing is done. The editing is done. And I sent, you know, my adjustments to the editing on their merry way. So at this point, it'll go to page processing and, you know, and what I would like is, I'm looking at a series of at least three, and if anybody ever reads them, then it'll go beyond that. But three of them will take care of a sort of trilogy. And I've started the third novel, although I'm not very far into it.
So, same publisher, Covenant Books?
So far, yeah.
So far, yeah. That's another thing too, is this world, you know, going with the traditional route. It's a compliment to you that you can not only get a book through a publisher, but be optioned for sequels. That's great.
Yeah, well, it's more complicated than that, as you know.
Yes.
But that's where it is. So.
Yeah, very cool. Well, okay, so Does the book, I it's a stupid question, but I'll ask anyway, does the book offer any surprises to the reader? Are they, do you think that, as you talked about that narrowing that to that path, is when you hopefully it gets to the conclusion that makes the most sense, but does that necessarily get in the way of the, you know, the mysterious twist ending that everybody's always kind of looking for?
No. No. It, without giving anything away to ruin it for potential readers, the cast of characters and the experiences is told in the first person. You know, I write in the first person, so that limits my options in many
Right,
ways.
right.
But I wanted to do it that way for that very reason. I wanted it to be, plus, again, this is kind of an homage to, you know, writers like Raymond Chandler or John D. MacDonald, or, you know, some of the people who have written good American mysteries over the years. So it's, and a lot of those are written in first person as well. So
Yes.
that has a lot to do with it. Think of a PI. A PI is not a cop. A PI is not a civilian, like in the cozy, a lot of the cozy mysteries. A PI is somebody that has chosen that profession for whatever reason. You know, there are a multitude of reasons, and I don't really get into that much, a little bit, but not really. That may be explored later, but with this first novel, it really isn't. I really don't dig into it that much in terms of explaining why the guy is a PI. But if you think about all of the PIs, even those that have been written more recently, not out of the 30s necessarily, but you know, some of the really good private investigator sorts of novels, and the one that I like, I've always liked, is the Spencer novels written by Robert B. Parker from Boston. Yeah, really good stuff. And in fact, what, you know, part of the reason why I like him is because his writing isn't dissimilar to Raymond Chandler's.
Sure.
I don't think it's as intricate. I don't think it's as anywhere near as articulate as what Chandler was able to do, but then whose is? I mean, you know, but still, I think Robert B. Parker is a very, very good writer, was a very good writer. And he wrote, I don't know how many Spencer novels, a ton, you
Yeah.
know, just lots
Yeah.
and lots. But his creation of the private eye, to get back to my point before I drifted, is my creation of, or his creation of the PI was very similar to Chandler's Philip Marlowe, and some of the others that came out of that era. So he recognized where the roots for his character came from, and he didn't disabuse his characters of those roots. He sort of honored that tradition, and I kind of like that. You know, I think that there's a continuity there that, if you're a reader, you like that. You know, you like it's sort of like a world that has been created many years ago, and yet there have been many, many people in a literary way that have lived in that same world, different
Right.
places, different kinds of situations, but still, the PI is the PI is the PI, and typically, he's a sort of or she is a sort of not a loner necessarily, but somebody that operates individually and has the sort of personal credo that comes out of a solitary kind of person.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are, I mean, if you think about Philip Marlowe, he's a very much like his author is sort of a tortured soul in many ways, and he's always kind of working through that as he gets into his cases. And it seems like the people he meets along the way tend to be in the same kind of boat that he's in, and you know, and that obviously is intended by Raymond Chandler. Robert Parker does the same thing.
Yeah.
So having said all of that, I think that the BI there are, you know, I told you, use the illustration of the wide vista when you start writing a
Right.
novel or whatever it is, and then it gradually narrows down because you're aiming towards something at the end.
Right.
You may not know what it's going to be exactly, but you're aiming in that direction. Well, I think that that is the case with the private eye. If you select a private eye rather than a policeman or policewoman, or in the cozy mysteries, it could be, God only knows what it could be anything. You've already limited yourself in a way if you're going to be true to that genre. And the good part of that is that it is it well, I don't want to say this. It is it's a path that people have tried before successfully, and it's a way of looking at the world that tends to be somewhat limited. If you've created a soul that is very much like those that were created back in the 30s. On the other hand, it's a comfortable place to be.
Yes.
So instead of having to recreate a world, you've already got a world that's out there that you can live in while you're writing it. So I think that just the selection of the PI was part of it. That's part of the reason why I like mysteries. I mean, mysteries that I've always enjoyed. I like Agatha Christie. You know, that's another favorite author. I like the old timers. Mm-hmm. I'll admit that. Although there are some, but there's a lady from Australia, Franny Fisher novels, that ring a bell?
Yeah, huh?
Good stuff. I think, let me see. Carrie Greenwood is the author of these novels, in case you're interested.
That's a good name.
Yeah, it is a good name. It's well written. Her novels are well written. She's written a lot of them. Now, they're not, you know, if you like me, if you hold Raymond Chandler up on a pedestal, then none of us can reach that lofty height, especially me, but even Carrie Greenwood can't. But then that's not what she's trying to do either. Right. She has an entertaining kind of a set of cozy kinds of mysteries.
Right.
And that's good stuff. And then there are others as well. I mean, she's only one. Anyway, the point I was driving at is that the writing of the mystery for me has. I used to ride bikes, motorcycles.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what I like doing, because I grew up in the Midwest, so everything is flat, and the highways tend to be north, south, east, west, you know. But every time you come to a river, there are always roads, you know, mm-hmm. and that's fun on a bike, because you have to take those sharp curves. It's kind of like a sports car, except, you know, even more so. And what keeps you centered is whatever is around you. I mean, if you're driving down a gravel road, then there's not much. Right. But if you're driving down a paved road that with two lanes, then you typically have guards. You know, well, that's the way it is with, in my case, that's the way it is with writing this kind of mystery. You've got guardrails, you've got places you can't go up, beyond which you can't go without, you know, bringing danger into it. I mean, in terms of writing, not the story, but the guardrails for writing, you're limited. And that's good, because that forces you to be disciplined in what you're doing. I'm babbling here. Are you?
I'm enjoying this. No, I have a similar, I was going to mention though, that, and being a big Chandler file as you are, and I have deep respect for you, probably, you might raise an eyebrow when I tell you that I absolutely love Dashiell Hammett. Nick and Nora Charles. I mean, he kind of breaks the mold a little bit, doesn't he though? Cause he's married, he's happy. He's kind of, I love the banter, the dialogue, and the movies, mm-hmm. especially. I really enjoyed that aspect, but to me, Dennis, one reason I think of them is it sounds a little bit like what you're saying is, you know, there are elements of cozy with that in the sense that it's lighter, you know, although he's an actual private eye, he just married into a socialite's family and blah, blah, blah. But there's also the hard-boiled elements too. They walk, it kind of walks its own line there. I think it's I guess we could call it, and I don't know if Dash Hammett would feel nice to hear this, but it's kind of an offshoot of the Chandler tree, though, that went a different direction, don't you think?
I think that's probably true. Didn't he precede Chandler?
He did, to a degree.
They overlapped.
The Glass Key, I don't remember the Glass Key. I'm trying to remember. But yeah, I think they did, right? A little bit. And he was what, with Lillian Hellman? They were together. And there's just so much that era that is so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, he wrote during the late 20s. You know, he wrote about the late 20s. And with Chandler, it was mostly the 30s and then into the 40s. I think Chandler's the last Philip Marlowe novel was in the 60s, early, like 61, 62.
My goodness.
But he had a lot. He wrote a lot of novels. I'm also Nero Wolfe. I like I like the
you don't hear Nero Wolfe anymore, do you?
No. I love that guy.
Oh my god.
Talk about a formula. He had a formula of success. 64 different novels, I think.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Oh, Dennis, well, we're lightning rounding here for a second. Did you by any chance catch on HBO the it's only two seasons, the reimagining Rand Burr played him. Oh my gosh, but Raymond Burr didn't do this. I'm just blanking on the name. This is so embarrassing. Raymond Burr is famous for playing
Perry Mason.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Gosh, it's great getting old, folks. Did you happen to see the reimagining?
Tell me about it.
Oh, come on, man. We're closer in age than you may think. But anyway, but did you happen to see any of that? The Perry Mason reimagining?
No, I saw the originals, but.
Right, but he's much more of an investigator than an attorney. Yeah. And it's really gritty. And it's like, it's almost as if they took Perry Mason and they bathed him in like a Chandlerian soup for a few weeks. It's very raw. But if you're, I think someone who got the interest, at the very least, you might want to check into it. It's really interesting. There's so much there. And gosh, I could talk about this for hours, but I know we're almost out of time here, but I think you've kind of nailed it, though, folks, that the Dennis has nailed it, that he's got his bona fides here. And, you know, his character, T.B. Stone, is definitely got some of that DNA in him from both sides of the fence, so to speak, of the mystery. Is there any take you have, though, on this as about violence in the books? And how do you feel about violence and or more graphic things in your work?
Wow, there's a question. As far as violence is concerned, if there's a proper context, I mean, if you're writing a war story, there has to be violence. I mean, there's no way of avoiding it. And if you try to soft pedal it, then you're just not being real. On the other hand, if you're writing about, you know, some of the part of the appeal for the cozy side of the mystery sort of world is that there's very little violence. Everything is sanitized. And to some extent that limits that particular approach and it makes it kind of vanilla-ish and it's not, Some of the writing is really good. I mentioned Cary Greenwood stuff and there are others. I mean, I'm not trying to dispute that. But like you, I think I a little bit of violence is part of the world. I mean, that's something that you can't really avoid. And the question is, what do you do with it? If you're writing in a way just so that you're getting the attention of somebody reading it, you know, you can be exploitive with violence or with sex or with any number of things. And all you're doing is trying to get somebody's attention with it. And to me, that's not doesn't serve any good purpose. I think it's a cheap way of getting attention to your whatever it is you're writing. Yeah. On the other hand, if like in this novel that we're talking about, there is violence, although it's not bloody, it's not anything like that. It is implied in most cases. I think there's as much. If you think about the way he interrogated the guy, and well, I don't want to give anything away, but his background, the backstory for T.B. Stone is such that he has a certain skill set that most private eyes don't have. And at least not by training or by, you know, maybe there's a certain tendency, but in his case, he knows exactly what it is and he knows exactly how to use it because he has before. Right. And so when he interrogates somebody, he does it methodically and he does it with skill. And there is a kind of violence that goes with that. And if you're paying attention to how it's written, hopefully that violence becomes obvious. Although he's not killing anyone, he's not torturing anyone, he's not doing anything that's obvious. If you think about what he was doing, there was a lot of violence that was implied. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. It's evident you have a deft touch with it, whether it's just enough. I've read some stuff, and I'm not by any means a shrinking violet, that sort of thing. But I, as a writer, sometimes I'll get into a book and it seems to be clicking along, and then they'll take this avenue And I'm like, was that really necessary? Did we really need to go that far? And then, but then I'm like, okay, let's finish the book. Maybe it was. And every now and then it's not. And I'm thinking, yeah, like you said, I think it's a rather cheap way to kind of, you know, prurience does sell, I guess, and all that kind of thing, but it's a rather cheap thing. And that's how I got my book. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dennis.
An example of what I think you're talking about, and also what I'm talking about. If you've ever read any Norman Mailer, I like Norman Mailer. I like what he wrote. He's a character, or was a character, but his first book, it was about World War II. It was about, and there was a lot of violence, a lot of it wasn't gratuitous at all. It was realistic. And it was beautifully done. The man knew how to write. I mean, he was wonderful. You may not like him as a person. You may question some of the things that he wrote about, but he was a writer. And when he created a scene, a lot of it is, you know, I read him or read that first novel. What was the first one? He sold a kajillion copies of it. It was a wonderful book.
It wasn't the Naked and the Dead.
Yes, 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 yes. That's just what that it was. Yeah.
He wrote Naked that in the 40s. Dead. Yeah,
okay. In the 40s. Yeah, Naked and the Dead. And the title itself tells what the story was about. I mean, that's exactly, you know, if you read that title and you think about what that means, the Naked and the Dead, you know, you can draw all kinds of things, all kinds of images, all kinds of conclusions about it, and none of them are wrong. When you actually read the novel, it would have been impossible for him to write that book without violence, without blood, without all of that. And so there's a time when that is important, depending on what you're writing, of course. But he was never a gratuitous. He was never he didn't write for prurient reasons. He wrote because he was describing something that needed to be described, and you knew it as you were reading. You didn't have the sense that. Right. Oh, that's just, you know, why would anybody do that? That there was none of that. I mean, it was all because it had to be.
Right.
And I think you're just as guilty of you know, the sins of a writer if you write something simply for sensationalism. I think you're just as committing just as many sins if you do exactly the opposite. If you refuse to write something realistically because you don't want to make it more violent or introduce violence into the world or whatever, well, you're not being true as a writer, are you?
No, you're not. And there's plenty of room in children's fiction, if that's what you want.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Dennis Feetz is the author of Love, Pride, and Murder. It's a riveting murder mystery, and it's told through the eyes of the, as he says, decidedly not hard-boiled T.B. Stone, but as he also adds, Dennis does, that he is, nor is he painfully rational. It's got so many layers in it, folks. I think you're going to want to check this out. If the book has as many layers as this conversation was going into, I think you're going to have a lot of fun. Hey, Dennis, is there any way, where do we get this? Is there any way to get more information about you? Give us a thought on that.
I do have a webpage. It's author, comma, critic. And stuff, author, critic, and stuff, ampersand instead of author, critic, ampersand, and stuff. And you can also just go on the web and type in the title, Love.
I just did. Hey, I just found it's DennisAFeast.com, right? There, that's good, right?
Okay, good. And if you type in Love, Pride, and Murder, again, using the ampersand, you'll get... a whole host of connections, places to buy it, comments about it, all kinds of things. And there are several reviews that are out on YouTube as well. So you can, I'm sure none of them will be nearly as good as this one. However, there are a couple of them that are out there.
And fear not, brave listeners, I will have everything in the show notes of this here episode. And if you want detailed stuff and pictures and all the good stuff you come to expect from Mysterious Goings On, go to mgopod.com and you'll find the show notes to this here episode, and you can learn more about Dennis Feetz, and probably should subscribe because he's got another book on the way, or two, or who knows how many. Dennis, I could have talk to you for an hour, but then you would have had to poison yourself to get away from me. But I'm glad you enjoyed it. I sure did. And hey, you got my email. If you want to come back when you have a new book, we'd love to chat again. Though I promise you, I'll probably start talking about other stuff, and we'll both.
That's okay. That's,
is that good for you? All right.
Absolutely.
Good. All right, Dennis Feast. Thanks again for joining us here on Mysterious Goings On.
You're welcome. Take care.
Thanks for joining us on Mysterious Goings On. Be sure to follow Mysterious Goings On wherever you get your podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget, you can get the links to books and other things mentioned on the show at mgopod.com. Until next time, keep reading.